The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Now, the command in the Torah is a command to Avram Avinu. God comes to Avram Avinu and he commands Avram Avinu that he wants Avram to perfect himself. Avram is created, man is created with a physical flaw. He wants Avram to perfect himself by circumcising. And the command, God says to Avram, the command for this perfection is going to be Himolachem Kol Zohar. Every one of your males has to circumcise, right? According to, and you'll never see in the Torah, it doesn't mention at any point in the Torah where the circumcision is supposed to take place, what part of the body is meant to be circumcised. Right? The commentaries understand that when God says every male has to be circumcised, that it is the point where the males are different than the females, right? That is the point where circumcision is to take place, and that's, we know it from the very, according to the tradition, we know it from the way it's written in the Pasuk. The perfection comes about through circumcision, right? We believe, according to our tradition, we believe that we are imperfect, and we need to be perfected through the circumcision. That means that there's a flaw. The orla, the foreskin, is a flaw, and that flaw has to be corrected. It's interesting, in the Israeli army, when you go for your profile, if you've been circumcised, then you automatically get 3 points taken off of your profile, right? That you cannot get 100% on your profile, you automatically get 3 points off for circumcision. The truth is that from a traditional point of view, we don't believe that. From a traditional point of view, we believe that if there is a foreskin, that would be a flaw, right? That without the foreskin, that's what actually brings about the perfection. God, the most basic idea behind it, what's the most basic idea behind circumcision? Is that God is telling the Jewish people, he's telling Avram Avinu, who is the father of the Gezuntah, he's the father of all future generations of Jews, he's telling Avram Avinu, you're the chosen people, and this is the covenant, right? It's a covenant that is going to be embedded in your flesh, right? It is sort of what we call the ancient world. There used to be this ritual, there was seal, they're packed in blood, right? I'm sure you've seen the movies where two guys sit down, right? And the cowboy and the Indian sit down, right? And they go, whoosh, right? And they go, whoosh, right? And they go, oh, right? And they press hands, right? And just one time I'd like to see the Indians like, Kimasabi, I have AIDS, right? That would be so funny. But that's the idea, there's this idea of being sealed, the pact that's sealed in blood. And all through history, that's something that in the world that always exists, this idea of sealing it in blood. It's much more of an impression, no pun intended, when it is actually carved into the flesh. That is how we know that it's a non-breaking covenant. We'll talk more about that later as far as what the rationale is. Now, the importance of the mitzvah can't be measured. The Jewish people have always done whatever is necessary to keep this mitzvah. The Talmud, actually, there's a story in the Talmud. There's a Roman emperor who said to his wise men, he said, if I have a sore on my foot, I have an irritation on my foot, should I cut it off and be relieved? Or should I leave it there and be irritated by it? That's what he asked his wise men. So the wise men said to him, you should obviously cut it off and be relieved. Now what is he referring, what was the emperor referring to? The emperor was referring to the Jewish people. Something you find in common, anti-Semites all through history. Very often, the attack on the Jews is very subtle. You'll find that by Haman and Ahasuerus. Never does Haman refer to the Jewish people by name. I want to wipe out the Jewish people. He mentions Ahasuerus. There happens to be a nation. It's not worth keeping them alive. Let's get rid of them, and so on and so forth. Even in Germany, right? They didn't start immediately with anti-Jew, just pass a whole bunch of anti-Jew law, let's kill Jews, right? It began very slowly, right? One law followed another law. The same in Egypt when the Jewish people were enslaved in Egypt. It began very subtly, right? First they enslaved them, slowly but surely it increased. Circumcision, this Roman emperor says to his men, what should I do? Should I remove this sore from my foot or not? They said, yes, you should remove this sore. is one of the Romans was there, his name was Kittiah Bar Shalom. The Gemara says his name was Kittiah. On your sheet, I think it says Bat Shalom. It should say Bar Shalom. Kittiah Bar Shalom. Kittiah Bar Shalom said to the emperor, there are two problems. First of all, based on a verse from the Torah, he showed the emperor that you're not going to be able to get rid of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are always going to be, they're always going to be around. Second of all, even if you were to succeed in getting rid of the Jewish people, the people would refer to you as an empire that's been cut off, right? You're an empire that has a flaw because one of your nations, one of your subject nations has been removed, right? So why would you want to get rid of them? So the king stroked his beard and said, "You've spoken well, my son. However, we have a law in this country that anyone who bests the king in an argument is thrown to the fire," right? So they started leading this Kittiah Bar Shalom off to the flames, right? And on the way to the flames, one of the Roman women of high nobility, she was standing there and she looked at him and she said, "Now, isn't it a shame that the ship is going to go, but he hasn't paid the customs tax?" That's what she said to him, right? So Kittiah Bar Shalom understood immediately what she was getting at, and he immediately, spontaneously circumcised himself. Right? That means he understood she was saying, "You're about to die for defending the Jewish people. Isn't it a shame that you haven't paid the basic tax, which is to be circumcised?" Right? You're going to die as a Gentile, even though you spoke up for the Jewish people. He spontaneously circumcised himself. The Talmud says a heavenly voice, a basco, it's called a basco, a heavenly voice came out and said, "This man, Kittiah Bar Shalom, has immediate entrance into paradise, immediate entrance into Olam Haba." There's a story of a woman in Russia. A woman had a child. This is before they took down the Iron Curtain and things had to be done secretly on the sly. A woman had a child and they got 10 people together and secretly performed a circumcision without anybody. All right, they had to be done very quietly. They performed a circumcision, got everybody into the house. They're going to perform a circumcision. The mole came. The mole is the circumciser. The mole came. They did the circumcision. And the mother picked up the child, and she ran into the next room with the child, and they heard her weeping profusely. Right? And they didn't know, what's going on? I mean, it's emotional. It's an emotional thing. We'll see in a second. But, you know, what's the big fuss? They came. They said, "You know, what's going on? Why is it that you're so... The child was 1 year old at the time. Right? The mother said to them, "Look, you know, this child was born, and since the time the child's been born a year ago, I've wanted to have this child circumcised. Problem was that I knew that I couldn't get the circumcision together because circumstances weren't such to allow for it. So I decided I need a reminder that's going to make me understand the urgency of having this child circumcised." It's a true story about it. "I needed a reminder to make me understand the urgency of circumcising my child. So I decided that from the day the child is born, I'm not going to kiss the child until the child is circumcised. In that way, this natural urge that I have to kiss my child will make me want to get the circumcision taken care of as soon as possible." That's the story. I've heard several versions of how long it was that she went without kissing the child. The point is not how long she went without kissing. The point is that circumcision is the most basic mitzvah in identifying as a Jew. Now, people, there's a misconception that people think that if somebody's not circumcised, he's not Jewish. That's not true. Right? Even without circumcision, a person is Jewish, but it is a basic mitzvah, and we'll see later on what the significance is. Somebody who's not circumcised is punishable, the flaw for not circumcised is punishable by kares. Kares means premature death, right? According to some, it is death before the age of 60, according to the others, before 50, but it's divine premature death. It's not death administered by the court, it's death administered by God, and the punishment is kares. The importance of the mitzvah is so great, you know that on Shabbos is prohibited to do any type of elective surgery, right? Let's say somebody wants to have a nose job, right? It's scheduled for any time other than on Shabbos. You're not allowed to do elective surgery on Shabbos. Circumcision, if the child is born on a Shabbos, and 8 days later is the next Shabbos, which is usually when you count the day that he's born, any calendar year, it's actually 7 days, right? Shabbos, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbos. So 8 days later is the eighth day of his life. The halacha is that on the eighth day of his life he is circumcised if the circumcision is on time. So if he's born on Shabbos, the circumcision is always going to be on Shabbos. If he was born, a child who's born unhealthy, right? One of the most common problems is some type of jaundice. Like they have to measure something in the blood. There's something called a bilirubin count. And they have to measure it. There's a certain number. The child has to be below that number in order to have the circumcision done. If that number is high, or if the child has an eye infection, or any type of physical, if the child is born shriveled, right? If a child is born, some of the child looks dried out like an Esro. Right? Kind of like that. It's all shriveled up. The circumciser will not do this circumcision. Prohibited according to halacha until the child is nice and robust and can handle the circumcision. We put off the circumcision, the rationale in halacha is you could always circumcise again, you can't always have another child, right? If the circumcision is done and the child is not healthy, chas v'shalom, something can happen, and halacha always puts life ahead of all other considerations. So it has to be that the child is in a state where he will be healthy in order to have the circumcision. But if he is healthy and he's born on Shabbos, then the mitzvah is so great that the circumcision, there are all sorts of arrangements, how you bring the tools there and so on and so forth, but the circumcision would have to be done on Shabbos. Now, the ceremony itself, it begins when the child is born, and the first Friday night of the child's life, there's a celebration called a Shalom Zachar. You know what the word Zachar means? Zachar means a male, right? Shalom, the Zachar is a male, and it's interesting, the numerical value, I can't make something like this up, the numerical value of the word Zachar in Hebrew is the same as the word Bracha. Bracha means blessing, right? So the Zachar symbolizes a certain blessing. I made a Bracha before. The Zachar means Bracha, and the Shalom Zachar is the first Friday night of the child's life, and there's a celebration at the parents' house. Now, it's human nature that the reason why a fuss is made has nothing to do with the prejudices and the chauvinistic views of Orthodox Jewry, right? The human nature is that when a male is born, there is more of a celebration than when a female is born. You will see that when you have, I don't know if any of you have children, but when you will see that when you have your first child, right, when people on the street will ask you, you know, what do you want, a son or a daughter? Right? People always like, your wife looks like a Goodyear blimp, and people will say to you, well, so what is it would you want a son or a daughter? So you can say, doesn't matter as long as the child's healthy, right? And then you look, and if your wife's not listening, say, and it's a boy, right? So the human nature is such that a father wants a boy, right? When you have, when a son is right, I had a son. And no one goes, there's no back slapping when you have a daughter, right? When you have a son, you march into the local tavern, take a couple of beers, tie one on, and everybody has a good celebration because he had a son. When it's a daughter, it's human nature. It has nothing to do, it's not unique to Judaism. So the first Friday night, and you should know something, that you'll also find this out when you get married, that the wife wants, in most cases, the women want a son more badly than the men do. Because a wife wants that when she's going through the birth process, more than anything, she understands that her husband wants a son, and therefore she wants a son because she wants to please her husband. Human nature, you see, it's true. And therefore, the wife is as happy, if not more. And it's not a question of loving the child more, chas v'shalom. And even if, you know, it's not like it's a daughter, crushing disappointment. Not like that at all. People are thrilled when they have daughters too. Some people don't have children for a long time. You cut off an arm to have a child. But there is something, a subtle point of human nature that says you'd like to have that boy. So the first Friday night, they make a Shalom Zachar. Now the bris is made as soon as possible on the eighth day. Right? On the eighth day of the baby's life, as soon as possible, like all mitzvahs, you do the mitzvah as soon as possible. If I would tell you that tomorrow morning I'm putting a $50 bill in this next room over here, right? There's going to be one for every one of you, a $50 bill, right? One for each of you. And you could come down at any point during the day and take that $50 bill out of the room. Right? It'll be there all day, and nightfall will no longer be there. What time do you think you'll be in the room to grab the bill? Right? I think the line will be longer than the line by the lunchroom. Right? The line at the crack of dawn to get the $50 bills will extend all the way out the hall, out into the yard. Because it's human nature that when there's something to lose, I don't want to take a chance on losing it. when a person has an opportunity to do a mitzvah, so the Talmud says a person should always run to do a mitzvah, because you don't want to let the mitzvah have a chance to run away from you. So as early as possible on the eighth day, since the entire eighth day, once the eighth day has elapsed, you've missed the prime time for doing the mitzvah and the circumcision has to be done, as early as possible on the eighth day is when the circumcision has to be done. There are certain things we take into account, like when relatives can make, you don't have to make circumcisions, they're not made at the crack of dawn. Right? 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, usually right after the minyan, that's when circumcisions are done, because you want to have family members and friends and whoever it is that you invite, you want to have them attend. So you certainly don't have to tell everybody, yes, circumcision 4:30 in the morning, be there, right? Because nobody's going to show up. Now, the father, the mitzvah of the circumcision is on the father. Right? It's the father's mitzvah to have a son circumcised. You will see that at the ceremony, has anybody here ever been to a circumcision? You ever been to a bris? Right? Most people have probably been there. Now, I don't know what you've seen, what you haven't. I'll go into the scripture, what it is that happens exactly. First of all, the father is wearing the talis and the tefillin. It's usually done after davening, but even if it's not done after davening, so the father puts on the tefillin, he puts on his talis, and that's how he gets prepared to do the circumcision. And then when the circumcision begins, there's the mohel. Now, before we'll get to the mohel in 1 second, the mohel is the man who is going to do the circumcising. At the shul, or wherever it is that you do this, where you do the ceremony, the first step of the ceremony is what's written on your sheet. It says kvater. Kvater is an honor that is given, usually to a childless couple, where the wife, who does not have any children, takes the baby, who's going to be circumcised, and she hands the baby to her husband. And then her husband brings the baby into the room. Now, this is only a tradition. It is not something that is absolutely required by Allah. It's only, like all traditions, it is only a tradition. Not to make light of traditions. There's always a significance to traditions. But this is part of the tradition, that the wife who has the child has no children, she hands it to her husband. It's a form of prayer to God to make God see that what they want more than anything else in life is to be able to have a child. Right? So that's the mitzvah. Now, there is something called the Kisei Shel Eliyahu, the chair of the prophet Eliyahu. You're familiar with the story in the Torah of, if I were to describe an incident, a man took a sharp object and he saw a couple who were engaged in immoral behavior, and he took this sharp object and he brutally murdered them. Right? What would you think of? Right? Honestly.
OJ.
OJ, right? But there's a story like that in the Torah. Right? The Torah says that there was a couple, a Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman, and publicly they were behaving in a way which you wouldn't expect from a nice observant Jewish man. And one of the Jews, the tzaddikim of the generation, a man named Pinchas, he picked up a spear and he put a quick end to their behavior. Right? He killed both of them while in the act. Right? Now, the Torah says that why did Pinchas do this? Pinchas did it because it's an open desecration of God's name. So the Torah says that because Pinchas did this, God rewarded Pinchas with eternal life. Right? L'chein emor hinin nilson as brisi shalom, my covenant of peace. The commentaries say that Pinchas is rewarded with eternal life. The commentaries say, who did Pinchas eventually become? Pinchas eventually, his identity, he took on a new name later on in life. You know what his name was? Eliyahu. Pinchas eventually became the prophet Eliyahu. And we see in the Nach that when the prophet Eliyahu, it was time for him to die, he did not die a human death. Now this is not the oral tradition, this is already the written scriptures say that the prophet Eliyahu, the way his life came to an end, he was walking with his disciple Elisha, and a fiery chariot came out of the sky. Obviously there's spiritual symbolism in all of this. A fiery chariot came out of the sky. The prophet Eliyahu, he actually told his disciple Elisha before he went, he said, disciple, what is it? You have one last request. What would you like? And disciple Elisha said to Eliyahu, I would like to perform twice the amount of miracles that you were able to perform. We see an account in Nach of Eliyahu bringing somebody back to life. other miracles they performed. Elisha said, I would like to perform twice the miracles you perform. So Eliyahu said to him, if you could watch me ascend to heaven in this fiery chariot, then what you wish will be granted. If you can't, then it won't. Right? It wasn't a question of gambling, double or nothing. If you do it, don't know. It was a question of, if you're on a spiritual level, to watch me ascend to heaven, that means it's an indication that you're on a spiritual level that you're going to be able to perform all these miracles. Right? Elisha watched Eliyahu ascend, and then Elisha, the Nath goes on to say all sorts of miracles that Elisha was able to perform. Eliyahu HaNavi didn't die a physical death as we know it. He existed in a spiritual state, and then he would come back to earth at various points in various ways. Sometimes on Pesach, we have the tradition on Pesach, what's called the cup for Eliyahu, right? We pour out a cup for Eliyahu. Why do we do that? We open the door and we pour out, and we hope that some little old man is knocking on the door at that moment and looking for a place to eat the Pesach. And everybody says, ooh, you never know, right? That's what we're hoping for. That is what we're hoping Eliyahu HaNavi is going to show up. The prophet Eliyahu, according to our tradition, because he was Pinchas, and because Pinchas once took, because the area of circumcision was being desecrated when that Jewish man was performing the Avera, so the prophet Eliyahu is rewarded by God that he will be in attendance at every bris. So what we do at the circumcision is we put a chair, a special chair which is called Kisei Shel Eliyahu, and one of the people you honor at the circumcision, you honor some friend or relative or dignitary, to take the baby and place the baby down on the chair of the prophet Eliyahu. That's called the honor of Kisei Shel Eliyahu. And according to our tradition, anybody who is standing around Eliyahu's chair at the bris has all of their averas forgiven. Right? Now, it's not something to be taken literally. It doesn't mean, yee-haw, I was at a bris. Let's go to town, boys. And walk, it's time to, and then you go to town, do some averas, and go to another bris the next day, right? Just keep wiping the slate. It doesn't work that way. Same as Rosh Hashanah. It doesn't mean that just because the slate is clean, therefore it's telling us the value of being in attendance. Does not mean that, okay, everything is, you know, my name is a leap straight from the bris to your local McDonald's. It's not what it's saying, right? You have to, it's got to be taken in proper context. Now, The sanduk is unfortunately translated in Hebrew. I remember when the movie The Godfather came to Israel. I never saw it, but the movie The Godfather came to Israel. They translated it as the sanduk. The sanduk is one of the most important jobs at the circumcision. The sanduk is the man who holds the baby during the bris. Right now, he's actually participating in the mitzvah because he's holding the baby's legs apart while the circumciser goes to work. Right. Is considered such an act of importance that there are three people, the father, the circumciser, and the man holding the baby. For all three of them, the day of the circumcision is regarded as a holiday. For all three of them, it's regarded as a holiday. They do not say the Tachanun prayer, one of the prayers that are omitted on holidays for the entire community. They don't say it individually on a day when they are involved in the bris, and if they're davening in your shul, the entire shul doesn't say this prayer because it's their personal holiday. Same way as somebody who gets married. For 7 days after he's married, when he davens in your shul, you leave out these prayers because for him it's considered a personal holiday. So the sanduk is the man who's holding the baby on his lap, and we'll see later on what the significance of the sanduk is. Now, the procedure is as follows. If you're squeamish, right, as I am, I've never watched a circumcision actually performed. I wouldn't be able to handle it. We actually had a guy here on the JLE who was a pre-med student who was working in a New York City emergency room at a hospital, right, where I'm sure he's seen all sorts of good things. And we happened that the entire JLE went to a circumcision, and when we went there, at the circumcision, this guy passed out, right? And it was a pre-med student, right? So I spoke to the guy. The guy was doing the mila, the moil, was a friend of mine. So I said, first I spoke to the guy. I said, what happened? You know, why did you pass out? He said, well, he was a little hot and he hadn't had breakfast that morning, so he was very vulnerable, and there was a little more blood than he expected to see. And I spoke to the circumcision, I spoke to the moil, a friend of mine, I spoke to him afterwards. And I said to him, you know, the guy passed out. He says, well, the truth is that when he went home from the circumcision, his wife said to him, did something go wrong today? He said, no, I said, anything wrong. He says, you've got blood on your collar. He said, in his entire career, that was the only time any blood ever spurted onto his shirt. He said, it happened to be a geyser, right? So, you know, that it just happened to me, the baby, you know, it was, but in general, there's much, it's not quite, you know, it's not a major, it's obviously not a major operation, but there is a certain amount of blood. So I do suggest, and I see this almost at every bris that I go to, that people, everybody pushes up close to watch, and inevitably you see some guy walking like, you know, walking away like that. So I would say that before you go, you know yourselves, if it is good for you to be all the way up close, you fulfill the mitzvah even if you don't see the, you know, the action and the replays, right? So it's best to perhaps stay at a distance. Now the moel is the man who does the circumcision. Stereotyped as, you know, there's some old guy, you know, who probably smells like herring, running around with a sharp little knife. Where is he? Right? I'm looking for the baby. Right? The moels are trained, right? They go through a very rigorous training. They have to be certified by the Board of Health in any country where they're operating. They obviously, they're not allowed. I saw one book that said that the test for the moel, the ultimate test, for certification, was that he had to circumcise his own son. Right? Obviously, it can't be done in all cases. What if he doesn't have any sons? So on and so forth. But in general, the moel is rigorously trained, and in many cases is more capable of performing a tricky circumcision. Sometimes there are all sorts of tricky little things that happen. He's sometimes more certified, better trained to perform a circumcision than surgeons would be. Right? And remember, he's got the experience of years and years and hundreds of circumcisions. There's one moel in Yerushalayim who is the most popular one in Yerushalayim. He's probably circumcised close to half the males in Yerushalayim. Right now he has a son who's in the business. So they're well trained and they know their job. They come and they check the baby. The week before the circumcision, they check the baby. Sometimes they check the baby twice. They check the baby again immediately before the circumcision. You can have a situation, it's happened many times, where the baby's fine, everything's going well, and at the circumcision itself, the moel will show up, the tables are set, they're waiting for the celebration, and the moel turns around and says, okay, everybody go home, no circumcision today. Right? Because at the last minute, the baby refuses to cooperate, maybe he's got a fever, maybe he's shriveled up a little bit, maybe he's underweight, could be any one of several reasons. The moel will not, if there's any doubt whatsoever, the moel will not form. Our second son was a little small, is born a little bit premature, is a little small, and he looked to me like he was a little shriveled. The moel came over and he was just over the weight limit, right? And the moel was willing to do it on time. But if he would have been just a couple of grams, about 20 grams or so, on the other side, then the moel wouldn't do it, right? Because at that point, halacha says that the baby's too small. So the moel is a responsible man who knows his business well. Now, at the actual circumcision, the father is in the talis and the tefillin, and what they do is the moel gives the baby to the father. Right? They bring the baby in. The couple that I told you about before that doesn't have children, they bring the baby in, and eventually the baby ends up by the father. The father takes the baby, and then he places the baby on the lap of the sandak, the man who's going to do the circuit, who's going to hold the baby. The father places him on the sandak's lap. The moel whispers to the father, he tells the father beforehand, what you're doing is you're placing the sacrifice on the altar. Right? This is as close as we Jews get to human sacrifice. Right? Somebody who's just got a burning desire to be involved in human sacrifice, this is it. Right? When you take your child, you put him on the lap of the moel. Let me tell you something. For the father, it's gut-wrenching. Right? For the mother, it's Gehenna. Because a woman who's just been through a birth, right, her entire system, her hormones are haywire, she's very emotional, she's in physical pain. Next thing she knows, this little baby, the soft, gooey baby, they're taking the baby away, she hands her baby to her husband. Next thing she knows, the baby's in a crowd of men, all of whom have beards, and one of them's got a knife, right? Now that's what's going through the mother's mind, right? So for the mother, this is a tremendously emotional time, and it is considered a sacrifice for the parents. The father makes a blessing, and remember, the moel is doing the mitzvah that the father should be doing. It's actually a mitzvah for your father to be circumcising his son, except that technical circumstances, i.e. the father is not quite as deft with a knife as the moel is, technical circumstances are preventing the father from doing the circumcision. There are some men who will make the first cut. They want to be involved in the mitzvah. They'll make the first cut at the circumcision under the careful scrutiny of the moel. and only if their wife has agreed to doing it, to allow them to do it, even though technically the father doesn't have to ask her. I'll get the question in 1 second. Even though the father doesn't have to technically ask her, but they want to be involved in the mitzvah. Now, what the mohel does is he takes a shield. There's a stainless steel shield which is shaped more or less like this, right? It's stainless steel, it's one piece of metal. And the circumcision is a three-step process. Now, for those of you who don't want to watch, you can just close your eyes and plug your finger in here, but I'll explain to you what, more or less what's happening. There's the foreskin, which has to be cut off. Under the foreskin, there's a thin membrane. This thin membrane has to be torn and peeled back, exposing the child. The mohel, if you ever see a mohel up close, his thumbnails come to a point like this, right? Not a sharp point, but they're trimmed in a point so that he can use his thumbs to rip back that membrane. The whole procedure takes under a minute, right? Before you know it, it's over, right? All you see is the mohel makes a bracha. The father makes a blessing. The mohel makes a blessing. Next thing you see is like this, the mohel bend down. Right, that's it. The whole thing is very quick. Now there are three steps the mohel is doing. Number one, he's cutting the foreskin. He takes that metal clamp and he puts the metal clamp over the tip of the baby's organ so that he doesn't chas v'shalom injure the baby. And then basically all he has to do is cut along it. Right, the baby is protected. Right, it's not, you don't have to use the metal clamp, but for protection, obviously, it's better to use it. The baby, incidentally, we'll talk about the pain in a second. The mohel pinches up the skin with the foreskin on it. He puts the clamp on. He cuts. And again, I'm telling you this from the books, right? None of this has been witnessed by me.
Please turn the tape to the other side.